From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, the state's out with latest scores from its new student evaluation test, MSTEP.
The vast majority of our students, from the results, it's clear, are not getting what they need to be successful.
Could dental therapists improve access to dental care in Michigan?
Truly a mid-level provider that extends the services of a dentist, but is a narrower scope than what a dentist can do.
We look at the pros and cons. College football back this week. Sports commentator John U. Bacon thinks it's past time to end football at Eastern Michigan University.
They've had one winning season in the last 20-some years. In 1995, they've won one league title in 43 years. Pull the plug.
Those stories and much more today for you on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Coming up, harnessing the power of pasta to help post-earthquake Italy. But first, as the Flint water crisis blew up, Governor Snyder hired two law firms at taxpayer expense to help with his legal defense. The initial budget for that work, $400,000, but that was used up in just February and March. Today, the State Administrative Board raised the budget to defend Governor Snyder and the Department of Environmental Quality up to $7.9 million. $3.4 million of that is for the governor. And that does it for Flint's Democratic State Senator Jim Ananick, who's getting ready to introduce a bill pertaining to private counsel on the public's dime. Senator, welcome.
Well, thanks for having me.
What's in the bill you're preparing?
Obviously, the intent is to rein in sort of this outrageous amount of public dollars being spent on private counsel with no oversight by anyone except the administrative board, which basically rubber stamps whatever the administration wants to do. I want to make sure we have justice, and I want to make sure that there's obviously, it's a fair justice process. But, I mean, when it's criminal attorneys, which is what it says in the appropriation, that the vast majority of this is for criminal, I mean, that should be done through a legal defense fund and should be paid for with non-taxpayer dollars. I mean, you know, obviously, a lot of money is being spent on Flint, and I think the residents of Flint deserve it. But this is taxpayers' dollars, and it's taxpayers' dollars from all across the state. It's hardworking money, and it needs to be spent on things that help people. And it does matter, and I think it's important to start this conversation. And I think under state law, they already should be using private dollars. But, you know, this legislation is to make sure that happens.
So this legislation would basically close the door to using taxpayer funds to hire private counsel?
Well, it'd make it much more difficult. It'd have to be, I mean, the Attorney General's office is generally charged with doing this. Obviously, there's a conflict in this case. So it wouldn't completely close the door, but it would make it much more, the citizens would have much more clarity to make sure that tax dollars aren't wasted on high-priced outside counsel when terrible decisions are made by members of the administration. And I think that's one of the things that really needs to be highlighted. This never should have happened. And to then use taxpayer dollars and private counsel as opposed to Attorney General's, you know, if you're doing something within your purview of your job, you know, people need to be protected. But when it's criminal charges or trying to avoid a criminal investigation, that's a little bit different.
I'm interested in your thoughts on a couple points made by the governor and his team. He's defending the cost, points to having to release some 180,000 pages of emails and documents related to Flint water. That's a lot of digging and producing and legal time. The governor's press secretary argues that using public money makes things more transparent because the contracts are being released publicly. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, in most states, you know, there is some form of FOIA already in place for the governor's office and legislature. We don't have that here. We're one of the least transparent states in the country, often rated 49th or 50th. What most states take for granted as far as, you know, communication between departments, the public has a right to that. It doesn't cost millions of dollars in outside counsel. I would assume you could, you know, just release that information to people. I mean, I want to see this be as transparent as possible, but there's been no steps made by the governor or even the legislature to move in that direction, right? I mean, obviously, we're spending millions of dollars, and there's no steps to make the governor's office FOIA-able. They're releasing this information, but nothing says they have to. And they could stop it at any time, and they're releasing it when they feel like releasing it. You know, obviously, we need to have a more transparent government now, but in the future as well.
Flint Democratic State Senator Jim Ananick. Senator, always good to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Today, the Michigan Department of Education released results of the MSTEP standardized test that 3rd through 8th graders took last spring. The MSTEP, you'll recall, is the test that in 2015 replaced the old MEEP test.
Let's look at how Michigan students did as we welcome Sunit Bedi, who's the data and policy analyst with the Education Trust Midwest. It has been a big adjustment for school administrators and students after 44 years of the MEEP. You stop and think about that, switching to MSTEP. And the four subject areas being tested are English language arts, math, science, social studies. And some 650,000 kids in grades 3 through 8 took the MSTEP. So there we have that. How'd they do?
So Michigan's performance on the most recent MSTEP assessment is relatively comparable to last year's assessment results.
Which was, as I recall, kind of grim news for lots of schools.
It was. The vast majority of our students, it's from the results, it's clear are not getting what they need to be successful. Overall, when we look at the percentages between 3 through 8 in English, language, arts, and math, we're seeing relatively the same percent proficiency. So for English, language, arts, we're at about 47% proficient.
Okay.
And in mathematics, it's 37% proficient, which is where we were at last year, about the same. There are some areas where we've seen some improvement. In fourth grade math, proficiency rates improved about 3 percentage points from last year. But we've also seen some drops. In third grade reading, we saw a couple points drop.
So it sounds like overall we're saying that basically we have something like half or a little more than half of students who failed to demonstrate that they're proficient in any of those four subject areas. And this is across the state.
Yes. And the results that I've shared with mm-hmm. you are English, language, arts, and math. But yeah, they're relatively the same across the four subject areas. But while that news is difficult to take, we do need to remember that this is a relatively new assessment system that the state has implemented. It is a better assessment system from the previous 44-year-old MEEP. And so our students and our teachers are adjusting, and we've gotten better from last year. The results have come out sooner, which is great that the Michigan Department of Education was able to deliver on that. And testing went smoother this year, it seems, statewide.
And they did tell us when this was coming, you know, hey, everybody strap in. It's going to be a bumpy ride for a few. You're going to have air turbulence for a while everybody settles into this.
Absolutely. And we need to remember, too, that this test is now giving us more honest information. And that's something we need to prize.
Yes, but it's really something that throws down the gauntlet to schools all over the state. Do better.
It does. But at the same time, we do need to be honest with ourselves so that we can help those students who are struggling to better achieve. And so while the results are devastating, mm-hmm. They tell us the reality of where our state is at and what we need to do to start supporting those students.
When we see this significant number of students who are still testing below proficiency, is it more a matter of this is a tougher test and people are getting used to taking it online? We saw this year 95% of students took it online. Or is it what instruction they're getting week after week in the classroom?
With this new assessment that is aligned to our higher standards, it's a little bit of both, I would say. The standards are newer, and so our teachers are still adjusting and need more investment in how to teach those standards. So that is one component of this, no doubt. We've seen in leading states that when they've made the shift to higher standards, teachers have been given greater support from the state.
Now, we've gotten very clear signals from the school reform office in Lansing that schools that are in the basement with their scores for several years could be on the bubble, could be closed. And that's even though the Department of Education had promised schools they would have at least another test cycle to settle into MSTEP and get used to that before closure decisions are made. So I just wonder where you think today's results might fit into this conversation, which is going to be a brisk one for the next few months as they decide what's going to happen.
In any decision, you want to ensure that there is honest information coming out. And so first and foremost, we need to make sure that the information that we're getting is good and valuable information. Secondly, though, you also want to make sure that there is consistency in the assessment that you're using to guide some of those decisions. And so we need to be thinking about how we're using that information at this time.
What should parents take away from these announcements today, the mixed results of the MSTEP test?
I think one thing to take away is that our state is adjusting and getting better at this assessment. Our teachers and students are rising to the challenge of this new assessment, And we see that through how smoothly things have gone in the second year. These are things that we should be proud of. But at the same time, we should take away that we need to keep demanding better for our students and ensuring that support is given to our teachers and our students to meet the benchmarks they need to meet.
It'll be interesting if you and I are having this conversation 1 year from now when they'll have the third MSTEP under their collective belts in school across Michigan to see what kind of results we might see there. Any hopes?
I think so. We've seen in leading states where similar tests have been implemented that as teachers are invested in and supported, as capacity is built for those educators, that scores do see an increase. And we can be hopeful that if our state can do that capacity building for our teachers and talent, that scores will likely go up. And so we really need to stay the course with a test that we've invested in. It was one of the most important steps we took to even move to the MSTEP. And it showed a commitment to wanting that educational improvement in our state.
Sunit Bedi is the Data and Policy Analyst with the Education Trust Midwest as we go over the results of the 2016 MSTEP scores. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
An invitation just to you. Come be in our audience when Stateside goes on the road. We'll be doing a show in Traverse City Saturday evening, September 17th. We'll be at the Inside Out Gallery right there in downtown Traverse City. Absolutely free, and all you need to do is register. Go to the Stateside page at michiganradio.org. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Time for our weekly check-in with Michigan Radio sports commentator John Eubank. And we have some great, great weather in store for this coming weekend. And starting Thursday, it might feel like baseball weather, but it is time for a new season of college football. So, John, shall we start with Michigan?
Why not?
All right, versus Hawaii on Saturday. And now we're hearing that Jim Harbaugh has announced his pick for quarterback and told the player, but everybody else can go whistle till game time on Saturday. Are you surprised at this strategy?
I'm not at all surprised. I'd be surprised were it otherwise. The whistle line is nice. It's a bit of classic Harbaugh right there.
Yeah, that's right.
We do know that it's down to Wilton Spate, who was the backup last year, and, of course, John O'Korn, who's a redshirt transfer from Houston, who I heard all last year was probably better than even Rudock, who was the starter, but of course he couldn't start O'Korn based on the red shirt. Now I think it's basically a toss-up, and I think very close, and it might be Wilton Spate.
Okay.
I don't know is the answer. The basic boil down is this. O'Korn probably has a higher top end, that great potential, but Wilton might be the safer pick. And on a team that has a lot going for it right now, maybe that's the way to go.
Well,
so
it's nice to
we'll
have the
find
problem.
Out.
Everybody finds out together.
It's a new problem for Michigan to have. We know that.
Over to Michigan State versus Furman on Friday, and we see Tyler O'Connor named a Spartan quarterback. We saw him step in, I remember, last season against Ohio State when Connor Cook was hurt.
One of the greatest Michigan State victories in the regular season of all time. They had no business winning that game with Connor Cook, their star quarterback, out of the game. Raining down there and so on, undefeated Ohio State, headed for the playoffs, it looked like, and those guys went in there and did the job. So Tyler O'Connor, I think, will be a solid pick, not a flashy pick, but good enough, like perhaps Wilton Spate, to not get you in trouble.
Western Michigan is going to be at Northwestern, starting the Broncos season on Saturday. And, of course, we know the season starting on an unfortunate note with freshman Ron George and Bryson White being kicked off the team after being arrested in a home invasion case. That's got to be a tough challenge for Coach Fleck to get everybody settled down.
It is, no doubt. And yet what I've noticed with big-time coaches, and P.J. Fleck almost is one. He was going to be going somewhere probably sooner than later. Lou Holtz, the old Notre Dame coach, was famous for sending home one of his stars within a game or a night or two of the actual bowl game. And that always inspired his team. So don't be 5 minutes late at Notre Dame for the curfew. This is more serious than that,
yes,
obviously. This
course.
Is a felony. But my strong hunch is the team will, in fact, rally.
And, in fact, we know on a happier note, this team's coming off one of its best years ever.
They went from 1-11 to 8-5 and 8-5 under P.J. Fleck, which is why, again, I think he will not be there very long.
And they actually got their first bowl game win.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, we can't forget the Chips, Central Michigan hosting the Presbyterian Blue Hose on Thursday, which is, to me, just an absolutely awesome team name. And there's a lot of buzz on campus about quarterback Cooper Rush.
That is correct. They've got about two dozen players in the NFL right now. CMU is cranking them out. In the same way, we'll get to Eastern Michigan shortly,
yeah,
that Butch Jones, former coach, is now at Tennessee, and they're a top team again. You've got Brian Kelly at CMU. Now he's the Notre Dame head coach. Of course, before that is Herb Duramity, who's a legend. Mm. Max, all-time winningest coach. CMU has got a great formula there, and they do put players in the NFL. This guy could be the next one.
Eastern Michigan will be hosting Mississippi Valley State on Friday, and there were so many questions earlier this year about whether EMU should drop its football program or switch conferences. So, and the heads of the school came out and said no to both.
That's correct. I was one of those voices.
Okay,
saying
why?
That I think very simple. You're spending $34 million per year on athletics. About 30 of that goes towards football. Nobody cares about it. They got the worst attendance in Division I. The students want it gone. The alumni want it gone. And it's costing money. And 10% of the $10,000 in annual tuition that you pay at EMU goes to athletics, whether you like it or not. Whereas almost nothing from Michigan from tuition goes anywhere down the hill. So you are paying for this 10% a year, and you don't even want it. That, to me, is crazy.
So it should go.
It should go. And look, right now they're 3-21. I mentioned earlier how CMU is the cradle of coaches. Sad to say, EMU is the graveyard of coaches. They never win there, and they've had one winning season in the last 20-some years. In 1995, they've won one league title in 43 years. Pull the plug.
And we can't let you go without getting your thoughts about 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick and his anthem protest. He says he will continue to sit during the national anthem to protest the way blacks are treated in America, no matter the cost to him as an NFL player.
Obviously, very controversial. He knew that going in. I'm sure he did. To me, it's a bit analogous, a miniature version of Muhammad Ali not being drafted to Vietnam and taking the punishment, which was jail time, during the height of his career. This is going to cost Kaepernick millions of dollars in endorsements. It will be an endless distraction for him. I've got pros and cons on it from a team point of view, obviously. But you can't say he's not committed. You can't say he's being selfish because it's not for him. It's for others. So, again, very controversial. But, look, this is America. And that's why we have the flag and all this good stuff, because we have the freedom of speech. And he's exercising that, as are those who don't like what he's doing.
Oh, social media is busy with it, isn't it?
They are very busy. And that's also First Amendment, by the way.
So that's true.
From my point of view, that thing kind of works. And the marketplace of ideas tends to settle these things pretty quickly.
Michigan Radio sports commentator John Ubig. And as always, thanks, John.
Thank you.
Michigan boasts an exceptionally rich mix of folk, ethnic, and immigrant music, and it goes back centuries. University of Michigan music professor Lester Montz wanted to capture that rich tapestry, so he spearheaded the Michigan Musical Heritage Project, and what a story it tells. Lester, so good to have you with us here on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia. It's great to be here.
Now, this project seemed to have three distinct goals. What are they?
One is to complete a full documentary on Michigan music. We hope to have that broadcast on some public television station. We hope to have cooperation from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and so forth. The second goal is to create an archive, a video archive of Michigan's music. We have a number of archives with audio examples, but not much with video. So that's the second goal. And then the final goal is for me to teach a course here at the university on Michigan music. I scoured through all of the catalogs of the public institutions in the state. I did not see one course that's fully dedicated and devoted to Michigan music, and I hope to be the first.
When we say Michigan music, what ethnic and immigrant traditions really jump out at you when we talk about Michigan music?
Not one really jumps out.
Yeah.
We're such a musical mosaic in this state that so many different immigrant groups, ethnic groups, folk groups have moved into the state, and many of them have maintained or compartmentalized much of their music and culture, but others have sort of fused together in such a way that they have created something very new.
So give me an idea of some of these traditions who are the more standalone ones versus who've done more morphing and evolving?
Well, look to the Irish Folk Music Festival in Muskegon. You do have a combination of both the things we were talking about. First, you have music that has benefited from jazz, from folk music, from other European immigrant groups. First of all, you have the fusion of the Scottish and the Irish together. And then on the other hand, you have this bluegrass music that takes shape in terms of its improvisation from jazz and other kinds of popular music. And so, you have in this one setting this real eclectic performances of music, which is really exciting.
Yeah, in fact, we should do a shout out because that Michigan Irish Festival is coming up in Muskegon in September, and it has been going for years. I was at the very first one when it was still very tiny and getting started, and it's been great to see it.
It was a lot of fun for us last summer.
Yes, and so you kind of spent the summer last year crisscrossing around the state going
last
to different
summer,
festivals, right?
The summer of 14 and the summer of 15 and 16. We have been scouting all of this out, and we have one more summer to go. There's so much happening in Michigan music, is you can't cover it all in one summer. And because we have to travel far distances to the Upper Peninsula, way out west, sometimes it takes us a whole weekend just to cover one festival.
And what are some of the other festivals that you've been able to grab?
We just came back from the Port Sanilac Blues Festival. This weekend, we're going to the Midland Festival. We've been to festivals in Hart, Michigan, the Hispanic Celebration there. We've been to the Old Time Fiddlers Convention in Hillsdale. There are about 25, 26 different festivals that we've attended. So there are many.
And the idea is, as you say, video. So unlike the very, very famous Lomax field recordings of the 20th century, you've got new technology to work with.
Well, you know, I knew Alan Lomax in my early days as an ethnomusicologist when he was still alive. He did some wonderful work here in Michigan, but he's not alone. A professor, an English professor in the engineering college years ago, a fellow by the name of Ivan Walton, collected a lot of music from stevedores, from loggers, from miners. And a lot of that music is in the Bentley, along with all of Ivan's handwritten notes. And I've looked at some of that. It's exhaustive. Mm. And then there's Laurie Summers, who operates out of the Michigan State Museum. She's done a lot of work on the Lomax collection. But you're absolutely right. What Lomax did was a lot of audio recording. We're following up on some of Lomax's work. I mean, just to show the time depth and how things have changed since the 1930s and the early part of this century.
It strikes me that I was listening to some clips as you talked to people at these different festivals, and it seemed no matter what group you're talking to, you could be at the Irish Festival in Muskegon, you could be at a German festival, but people have that same, they express the same feelings when they hear their music.
When they hear their music and they appreciate someone from the University of Michigan coming to record and explore the things that they enjoy. And that's been an expression that we've heard all over the state. Mm-hmm. Boy, we're really happy for you to be here. We really want to see ourselves on PBS. We really want to hear ourselves perform. And I must tell you, the level of performance that I've heard from some of these musicians is just astounding. I spent many years of my life as an orchestral trumpet player, playing with some of the top orchestras in the country. And I must say that the skill and musicianship that I have experienced around this state is just astounding.
Well, interestingly, you're going to give future generations a really wonderful snapshot of the way things are right now in the early part of the 21st century so they can measure down the road.
You'd be a great ethnomusicologist because that's one of the things that we often study, and that is how music changes, all right? And we have to have certain points along a timeline to make those kinds of comparisons to, through analysis, figure out how that music has changed. And I mean, I've done this with the work I've done in Africa. I've even done some of it with the work I've done in China.
Interesting, interesting. And so what's coming next? You're pulling this together. You still have another summer to hit festivals.
Yes. We're going to spend the winter months interviewing people. I want to speak with Fran Bluen, who is on our history department faculty. I mean, he's a historian of Michigan. I want to, you know, talk to him about how these various groups, immigrant groups, folk groups came into the state. I want to have some sit-down time with some of these musicians. I see them performing at these festivals. And in that context, it's very difficult to have a sit-down interview. So I want to invite them down to the campus, possibly for a lecture series, and to get the intimate details about how they were trained, what kinds of performance opportunities they've had, how they pass on these traditions to the next generation, so on and so forth.
Interesting. And eventually, I'm hoping, because I love folk music, I love ethnic music, that there'll be a big, juicy website for the rest of us to be able to plunge into and listen and explore what you've done.
We have a website that is about to launch. and it has a number of examples of the music that we've collected. Right now, we have a YouTube channel, and we have a number of pieces that we've collected over the past two summers, just to give people some idea of the work that we've been doing.
So if they search for Michigan Musical Heritage Project on YouTube, up it will come.
They will find it.
Exciting, exciting work from University of Michigan musical professor Lester Mons and his team, the Michigan Musical Heritage Project. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Eat pasta, and you could help the people whose lives were shattered by the powerful earthquake that struck central Italy. One of Detroit's top chefs is joining chefs worldwide in serving a special pasta dish, and he's calling on other Michigan restaurants to do the same. Chef Luciano Del Signore of Bacco in Southfield and Big Alora in Southfield, Ann Arbor, and Royal Oak. What is the dish, and why is it so significant in helping earthquake victims?
Well, first of all, Cindy, thank you for having me. The area that got hit the hardest by this earthquake was a town called Amatrice. And Amatrice was famous for inventing a pasta called pasta alla matriciana. Was invented right in that town that incidentally happens to be one of my favorite go-to pastas.
Really? So this is one you've made a lot?
A lot. I serve it to my friends and family on a regular basis. And it happened to be the 50th anniversary celebration going on in this town over that pasta celebration 3 or 4 days after the earthquake. And people were swelling into that town in anticipation of this big celebration festival they were going to have there. So there was more people in Amatrice than there normally is. Because of the celebration of the creation of that pasta. So, you know, it became very devastating. The count is, I think, surpassed 300 people, which is just awful. And counting, as I know, there's still people still missing.
What's in this dish? Tell us what it takes.
So pasta alla matriciana is made with guanciale, and guanciale is a cured pork jowl, and it's very similar to pancetta. And a lot of chefs use pancetta in Italian bacon in place of guanciale. But it's simple. It's sautéed guanciale, a little bit of hot pepper seeds for spice, onion, Italian plum tomatoes, spaghetti, or the traditional pasta is bucatini, parsley, and pecorino romano cheese. Those are the ingredients in the dish. We're going to post up recipes on how the dish should be made on our website and all the participating chefs. We told the chefs and restaurants who are doing this to, you know, if they can use an original recipe, I could give them a recipe, or they could be creative and create something special on their own.
And you're getting lots of chefs chiming in. So what's the idea? I can come into Bacco or Bigelow or any of the participating ones and order this dish?
That is correct. So we're having table cards made for the participating restaurants. We have 40 restaurants in metropolitan Detroit alone that are already signed on to this. And you go into any one of these restaurants, and you'll see the card on the table. You order spaghetti alla matriciana for $15, and 100% of those proceeds go to the fund.
And this starts, you're getting ready to get this launched as soon as possible, I'm sure.
It's the entire month of September. So we're starting September the 1st through the end of the month, and then at the end of the month we'll tally up the proceeds. I hope we originally asked to make at least $50,000 for the fund. I think we're going to get close to 100.
It's good to know you can harness the power of great pasta and help this town.
Yes, absolutely. It really needs help. I mean, everybody has seen the pictures on TV, and it's devastational to see these 500, 600, and 700-year-old buildings in ruins.
Chef Luciano Del Signore of Bacco and Big Alora, spearheading the cause to serve this wonderful... I want you to say it again, Chef, because you say it so well.
Bucatini alla matriciana from the town of Amatrice.
Wonderful. Chef, thanks for being with us today on Stateside.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Dental health is not just about appearance and avoiding cavities. It's critical in your overall health. Poor oral health has been tied to cardiovascular disease, respiratory infections like pneumonia, diabetic complications, dementia. So how do we get dental care to areas and populations that are underserved by dentists? Some in Michigan think Senate Bill 1013 could have an answer. That bill was introduced earlier this summer by Republican Senator Mike Shirkey of Clark Lake, modeled after a program in Minnesota. It sets up a mid-level dental professional called a dental therapist. Now, whether we need this new professional role in dental care in Michigan is up for debate. We start by turning to Dr. David Gesko. He's Senior Vice President of Health Partners in Minnesota, a large medical and dental practice. Dr. Gesko is past president and past member of the Minnesota Board of Dentistry. Dr. Gesko, welcome to Stateside.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Exactly what is a dental therapist? What can they do and what can't they do?
Well, Cynthia, I think your audience would be most familiar in the medical side of the world relating it to a physician's assistant or a nurse practitioner, truly a mid-level provider that extends the services of a dentist but is a narrower scope than what a dentist can do.
All right. So in terms of if I'm sitting in a chair and I have a dental therapist working on me, what might he or she do and not be able to do?
In Minnesota, the diagnosis and treatment planning of all care still falls to the dentist. And so once I've diagnosed and treatment planned you, for example, and if you needed some fillings, I could set you up with a dental therapist, and the dental therapist then at a subsequent appointment would do the same work that normally a dentist would have done. So they would begin by numbing you up, and they would prepare the teeth for the restorations and place the restorations all beginning and end on their own.
And then where would it stop? For instance, if I needed a root canal, God forbid, but if I needed a root canal, that would not be within the purview of the therapist?
Correct. That falls outside of the scope of practice in Minnesota and I believe in most cases where dental therapy is practiced around the world as well. So the if your listeners could understand that most of the what is constitutes fillings is in the scope of a dental therapist. And for children, their scope is quite extensive, so they can do stainless steel crowns and pulpotomies and other procedures that are done on children's teeth.
All right, so Minnesota started using dental therapists in mid-2011, 5 years ago. Tell us, as it's evolved, how does the program work, and particularly, what's worked well?
You know, it's clearly not a panacea, and I want to just make sure that everyone understands that this is not the silver bullet to solving all access problems. But how does it benefit the patient? And so in Minnesota, the legislature said that half of the practice of a dental therapist must be devoted to state public program insurance, or commonly referred to as Medicaid. And so what has worked very well in Minnesota is it has allowed a less expensive model of care to devoted to a reimbursement system that is generally not what dentists would like to see it. And so this allows us to be able to deliver care at a lower cost model, but at a very high quality level. It's the same quality. The training of the dental therapists is equivalent in their scope of practice to what a dentist gets.
So the dental therapist works within the dental practice and overseen by a DDS?
Correct. It's a new team member, just like, you know, at one point hygiene was new to dentistry, and so hygienists were created, and those providers, as we all know, focus on prevention and cleaning services and preventive services. Now this new provider has been introduced to allow their ability to do restorations. And it really allows the dentist now to focus on things that only the dentist can do. And as I like to think, float to the very top of one's license.
Now, where would you like to see the program shored up? Where has it fallen short in your view where it needs tweaking?
You know, right now it's running very smoothly. We have three dental therapists in our practice that work in our clinic system, and our patients have accepted them with open arms. We've not had any issues there whatsoever. The quality that they've delivered has been excellent. They're in the same quality assurance program as all of our dentists and all of our hygienists are in our program. And so I can't think of an area that I would tweak, Cynthia, but it's performing very well and it's running very smoothly.
Dr. Gesko, why not just expand what dental hygienists do? Why add another layer to the dental care practice team?
Well, in fact, that's in a way, that's what has been done in Minnesota. So there's two training programs in Minnesota, one at the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry, and then one in the community college system, Normandale Metro State. The latter program decided to accept only hygienists into their training program for dental therapists. And the University of Minnesota initially began by just creating new folks that are being trained as dental therapists. But in fact, this year, the dental therapy class in Minnesota has also evolved to producing dual-degreed individuals. They will produce a hygienist and a dental therapist at the end of their training program. So in a way, Cynthia, that is indeed what's happened, although it didn't start out that way, but that's the way it's evolved now, so that we're really having an expanded hygienist.
And as we're going to hear in a moment, the Michigan Dental Association is firmly against having dental therapists in Michigan. Was there similar resistance in Minnesota when the program was first proposed?
Yes, indeed there was. And, you know, the arguments were a concern over quality, that these folks would be doing irreversible procedures that only a dentist can do. And that is just not proven to be a situation at all, because they are trained exactly the same as a dentist is trained. And the exam that they take is exactly the same exam for their scope of practice that a dentist takes. And so that has proved to be a specious argument. And the public has accepted them well. It's a lower cost option. And really, I see no reason why this new team member in our dental practice should not go forward throughout the country.
Doctor, what is your response to the argument from the MDA, the Michigan Dental Association, that introducing dental therapists could create two standards of care? For those who can pay, they'll get to see the DDS like you are, and those who can't will have to be cared for by a dental therapist.
Well, I don't follow that argument at all, Cynthia, because the dental therapists in Minnesota in our practice, although, yes, 50% of their practice needs to be focused on the underserved, the other 50% can work on anyone. And so I would have no concerns whatsoever if I needed a restoration to have a dental therapist do that restoration, place that restoration with me. So this idea of two different standards is just not an argument that I'm tracking at all, because they're absolutely able to work on any member of the population. The legislature here just said, I really want to focus on the underserved, and so 50% of your practice must be there.
Dr. David Gesko, past president and former member of the Minnesota Board of Dentistry. Doctor, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome.
The Michigan Dental Association has been squarely against the idea of dental therapists, and it opposes Senate Bill 1013. So let's talk about why as we welcome Bill Sullivan, who's the Vice President of Advocacy and Professional Affairs for the Michigan Dental Association. Good to have you here with us, Bill.
Thank you very much.
Tell us why the MDA opposes dental therapists for Michigan.
The main reason is that it's unproven. There's only one state where this model has actually been used. The second thing is we don't believe it's needed. In Michigan right now, we believe the workforce exists that can deal with the access issue, and it's better utilizing the existing workforce that we think should be focused on.
So why do we have an access issue if we've got the workforce?
The problem is there's a maldistribution in the state. If you look at Michigan, there are dental shortage areas, and virtually north of Lansing is one big dental shortage area. And the reason that there aren't dentists there is because they can't make a living there. So there's an economic problem where people go into these areas and they can't economically sustain themselves. And there's also, you know, when talking to others, there's quality of life. You know, you don't have as much there as you do in population centers in the state. So there's no reason to think that you create a dental therapist that these people are going to be able to go into these areas any more than anybody else can right now.
Now, in Minnesota, a 2014 report from the Minnesota Department of Public Health finds that that program is bringing dental care to those underserved populations, charging less to patients, and helping dentists with another pair of hands. So wait times are shorter. So why would that not be something we'd want to see?
Well, if you look at what they did in Minnesota, when they were working on passing this plan, one of the things that they billed it as is the way to get care into rural areas, which you were just talking about. And if you look at what's going on in Minnesota right now, they're not going into those areas. There's about 56 practicing dental therapists in Minnesota, and all but seven of them are going into the rural areas. Why is that? That's because where they can make a living.
So what do we do to fix this? I mean, what would be the options?
Yeah, it's first of all, it's a very complicated
problem.
It is. Very complicated. And one of the things that we believe we should do is focus on Michigan's existing workforce. In Michigan right now, there's 7,500 licensed dentists. There's over 10,300 licensed dental hygienists, and there's over 1,700 registered dental assistants. If you look at the hygienists, for example, half or more are either underemployed or unemployed. We believe that we should utilize people who are already existing, have already been trained, and tap into their abilities and use them to help deal with the access problem. But, you know, that's only one part of the issue when we talk about workforce. A bigger part of the problem is simple education. A lot of people just don't value dental health. As a result, they don't go to the dentist like they should. I'll give you a statistic that I just found out last week from Blue Cross. For their pediatric population, this is for children who have dental insurance, 58% utilization. You know, even people with dental insurance aren't going to the dentist. You know, you look in Michigan, one of the things that they did to fix the access issue is, I don't know if you've heard of the Healthy Kids Dental Program.
Yes, let's remind everybody what that's about.
Sure. What Healthy Kids Dental is, it's a Medicaid program that is administered by Delta Dental of Michigan. Even though it's Medicaid, patients get a Delta Dental card. The dentists who are participating get to bill and get paid through Delta Dental. It's not through the state Medicaid system. So under Healthy Kids Dental and all the Healthy Kids Dental counties, 80% of the dentists participate in the Healthy Kids Dental program.
So you've got big participation.
Yes.
Kids can get there. It's easier for the dentists than
yes.
It would be if they were working through Medicaid.
Yep.
Could we see this expanded to adults?
Yes. And in fact, the governor tried to do that a couple of years ago. It did not make it through the legislature. The Senate tried to do it again this year, and it didn't survive. But I do know that there will be other efforts to create like a Healthy Kids Dental program for adults. Another point of Healthy Kids Dental that's important to note is the utilization of the children under Healthy Kids Dental has gone up dramatically from what it was under traditional Medicaid.
So that could be one solution. Back to the just looking at the geography, as you say, this kind of underserved area that's pretty much north of Lansing. Could we just argue that if you've got dental therapists who are working under the guidance of a dentist as part of a practice, being able to do fillings, could they not be, you know, do outreach kinds of programs? Wouldn't that expand a dental practice's ability to at least maybe, let's say, 2 days a week or whatever, have a clinic up where there aren't folks who, you know, where you don't have a lot who want to live there full time?
Well, you know, again, we talked about this a little while ago. The economic sustainability of the model has got to work for people to do it. And right now, dentists have capacity to take on new patients without a new provider being added into the workforce. You know, just recently, there was a group called Alterum, which did a study through the Michigan Caries Prevention Program. And they found that 74% of dentists are accepting new patients, new children patients. It doesn't make sense to put a new provider into that mix when you already have people who aren't busy enough and can see these patients. You know, we think a better way to do it is to allow the dentist to be able to send somebody out and do outreach, for lack of a better word, and see these patients and perform hygiene services on them. Right now in Michigan, we have what's called a PA-161 program. And what that does is it allows a PA-161 program, which can be like a school district, a public health center, a federally qualified health center, that program or entity is able to bring on a dentist as a supervising dentist. That dentist then can send out or supervise hygienists who go out into the community, perform hygiene services without that patient having been seen by a dentist first. And that program is something we think should be expanded. What we would like to see happen in a proposal that we're working on, and there will probably be a bill introduced next week, as a matter of fact, by Senator Pete McGregor, that will allow individual dentists to become a PA-161 program, and then they could send out a hygienist anywhere in the community. It could be to a daycare center, a school, whatever. The person could perform hygiene services, and then if there is
screen.
And then if they found follow-up care was needed, that person would have to be referred back to the dentist for care.
Just to throw this out here, as we heard from Dr. Gasco from the Minnesota Board of Dentistry, the past president, who said it's working in Minnesota that many hygienists have taken the extra training to become therapists. So they've got the bases covered so they could do, for example, fillings if they were out there.
Yeah. And, you know, that's another important distinction mm-hmm. I think we really need to emphasize is that they talk about doing routine procedures. Well, mm-hmm. keep in mind, the dental therapist model has people doing extractions. It has them drilling and filling teeth. And we feel that person with the most training should be doing those type of procedures. Now, as far as what the claim from Minnesota, mm-hmm. you know, I have to dispute what you were told, because right now in Minnesota, like I said, there's 56. This program was passed in 2009, so that's 7 years, and we have 56 providers. It costs about $50,000 to $60,000 to go through the program. And both schools that do the program in Minnesota, one is accepting 6 a year, one is accepting 8 a year.
So the pipeline is not big, you're saying?
Correct.
It could be grown, but how do you answer those who might see this stance as basically turf guarding?
Yeah, nope. And I think that's – we hear that all uh-huh. the time when we're talking about this issue. One of the things people got to keep in mind is that, you know, dentists are highly trained. They go to school for 4 years. Many have even more after that they get. And the reason that they get that extra training is because sometimes when you're doing the routine type procedures, something happens. And it's that type of thing that you need to be prepared for, that something, that unplanned for thing mm-hmm. that can lead to something worse. I can't tell you the number of dentists I've talked to regarding this bill. And the one thing that they always bring up is that they use the term simple extractions. And they said, you know what, everything's simple until it's not. And they can't tell you the number of times where they've been pulling out a tooth and something, you know, a vein has been ruptured or something to that effect. And that's when their extra training kicks in. Now, I'm not saying that the dental therapists are unsafe, but it's that extra training that's important. And, you know, the Michigan Dental Association's position is that dentists should be the head of the dental team and they should be the one that's performing irreversible procedures.
Bill Sullivan is Vice President of Advocacy and Professional Affairs for the Michigan Dental Association. Appreciate you being part of the conversation. Bill, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
And just in case you missed it, you'll find the interview that we did at first with Dr. David Gasco of Minnesota on our website, michiganradio.org. He addressed how the dental therapist program is working in his state. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors include Ryan Grimes, Josh Hakala, and Tony Brown. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.